All right, let's get started. So my name again is Adam Cox. I'm a professor at New York University School of Law and a member of the NYU Migration Network, which is a network of NYU faculty and researchers who work on questions of migration and mobility around the globe. This fall, like last fall, we're hosting an event series to explore the implications of using enforcement as a core feature of immigration policy, with a particular emphasis on studying detention and deportation. As part of that series, we're bringing you a set of explainers that cover some of the key policy concepts involved in detention and deportation practice. You can find the recording of today's explainer afterwards, and also past and future explainers, on the NYU Migration Network's website. That address is migration.nyu.edu. Today, on behalf of the network, I'm really, really delighted to introduce Ahilan Arulanantham. He's professor of practice and co-director of the Center for Immigration Law and Policy at the UCLA School of Law. He both teaches at the law school and also maintains a very active litigation practice. He has successfully litigated a number of landmark immigrants' rights decisions, including Jennings against Rodriguez, which secured the due process rights of immigrants jailed for years while they litigated their deportation case. And right now, he's lead counsel for the National TPS Alliance in their efforts to stop the Trump administration from rescinding the temporary protected status of hundreds of thousands of non-citizens living in the country. Ahilan, welcome.
Welcome, Adam. Thanks for having me.
We're here to talk today about an obscure legal term that has shown up again and again over the past 9 months in news coverage and discussions of legal challenges to various Trump administration immigration policies. The term, and I'll say this carefully for the listeners, is habeas corpus, an old-fashioned Latin word that keeps showing up when the Trump administration attempted to send 200 non-citizens to a prison in Central America. Habeas was in the news. When the government deported Mr. Abrego Garcia and quickly admitted that it had done so wrongly, habeas corpus was again in the news. And when ICE agents arrested Mahmoud Khalil on the campus of Columbia, placed him in deportation proceedings, the fight again was over whether habeas corpus would be available to help release him from detention. So habeas is everywhere, but we need to know what it is. So I guess I'd just like to start by asking you, could you explain for our audience what is habeas corpus?
Yes, habeas corpus has been called the most important human right in the Constitution. All it is the right to have a court or some other neutral decision maker look into whether the government followed the law when it locked someone up. So when the government imprisons someone, to say they have the right to habeas corpus is to say that they have the right to challenge the lawfulness of their imprisonment before a court, somebody independent of the government. And literally, habeas corpus is Latin. It just means show me the body. Because traditionally, what would happen is when the court was looking into the lawfulness of the imprisonment, they would order the king or the forces of who had imprisoned the person to bring that person to court for the hearing on their habeas corpus petition, which is their kind of case. And then if they won their case, then the judge could order their release.
Great, that's so helpful. And can you, to make that really concrete, can you explain how habeas has been central to some of these recent fights that I've described, the attempt to send folks to CECOT, the deportation of Mr. Abrego Garcia, or the detention of Mr. Khalil, the Columbia grad student?
Yeah, well, all of the cases that you just talked about thousands and thousands of others of cases over the last well, for decades, but certainly over the last 9 months, they have all involved the executive branch locking someone up. Right? All of them start with that. Abrego Garcia gets detained. Mahmoud Khalil gets detained. The Venezuelans who they were trying to send, the Trump administration was trying to send to the prison in El Salvador, were all locked up. And when they're locked up, the government's saying, we can lock you up because we're about to deport you. And so then they say, no, you can't lock me up. There is no basis to jail me and no basis to deport me. And so then that's the issue that gets put before the courts in the habeas petitions.
And is that something new that we're seeing now that we didn't see before, or has habeas long been a way that immigrants have contested government policies that detain and deport them?
Habeas is very, very old, and its use by immigrants is also very, very old. Feels a little odd answering this question from you since you have written so extensively about it. But habeas corpus is in the Constitution because it's a pre-existing right, and people trace it back to Magna Carta. So it's the 1215, I think, or something like that, is the sort of origin point of this right. When from the time of the founding, there are examples of non-citizens seeking to challenge their imprisonment on habeas corpus. And from the time that federal immigration law kind of really gets going, when it becomes a deportation and detention pursuant to deportation become pretty widespread, sort of around the time of the start of the Chinese Exclusion Statute, all of the cases, these are like canonical immigration cases, challenging various aspects of immigration policy, maybe not literally all, but many, many of them are habeas corpus cases. They're immigrants detained, say, in New York or in California, saying the government has no authority to jail me in this situation because actually I'm entitled to come into the United States or stay in the United States. And if you go back through history, sort of up from then, many of the most important immigration cases in the Supreme Court, so Vitus v. Davis, DeMoor v. Kim, Shaughnessy v. Mazai, so many of them are habeas cases.
So it sounds extremely old, and yet to me, it also feels new and different than what we've read about so frequently in recent years. During the first term when President Trump was in office, and also during President Biden's term, I felt like we frequently read about these lawsuits where, the state of Hawaii or the state of Texas or the state of Washington sued the government over its immigration policies. And it seems like instead of that, we're seeing these lawsuits by individual non-citizens, as you describe it, filing habeas corpus petitions. Why are we seeing such different suits now than we were seeing then?
So there are some suits by states some local entities also now in both directions, administration suing states and states suing the administration. But I think you're right. My sense is the same as yours, that the emphasis is somewhat different here. And I think there's a couple of reasons for that. One is that the Supreme Court has made it actually harder and harder for certain kinds of immigration policies to be challenged through other methods. So, state standing, for example, was cut back to some significant degree in the time period since the first Trump administration. In addition, the idea that this is not so much necessarily states that would do this, or they might, but the idea that you could just challenge one nationwide policy through a lawsuit that could be a class action suit, for example, challenging the legality of it all at once. That is an idea the Supreme Court has cut back a lot on in the immigration context in particular. So, for example, the cases involving the people sent to El Salvador, for those following that closely, they would know there's a blizzard of cases all around the country, all with these different initials, AARP, JGG. I can't even remember them all. There's so many different cases like this, which are coming up in different districts, all challenging the same basic idea, which is whether the president has the power to invoke this law called the Alien Enemies Act to summarily jail people and summarily deport them. Like, why is that happening? Why isn't it just one case that's a class action for everybody, or one case on behalf of some other actor saying you can't do this? And the reason is because the Supreme Court has said that they believe habeas cases have to be brought more or less by individuals, maybe a few individuals, or perhaps only one, but anyway, that they can't be brought as these class actions that are large that cross districts. And so they say, you can't bring it, around the whole country all at once. And that has significant implications, obviously, for how the cases get litigated as well, right?
Yeah, can I ask more about that? Because when you started, the first thing you said about habeas was it's the foundation of all rights. And so it sounds powerful. But I could imagine as a lawyer wanting to be able to bring one case in one place to challenge a policy on behalf of everyone, that would feel powerful as well. So I guess I want to know, practically speaking, how are lawyers bringing all of these cases if there are so many immigrants who might be affected by new Trump administration policies? How do all the cases get brought? And what happens for non-citizens who don't have lawyers?
These are such important questions in the present moment. I think that one of the many things the Supreme Court is doing to cut back on the rights of immigrants is making habeas corpus less powerful than it was. And that's something that's happened in this recent court has done, but it's actually something that's been happening over time. So there are class action habeases that are essentially either nationwide in character or at least very, very large to spread across districts. I mean, the case you mentioned at the outset in my bio, Jennings v. Rodriguez, which I argued in the Supreme Court twice, that case originally, the ruling that we took up to the Ninth Circuit spread across a broad swath of territory. And there were other cases that people brought that were actually nationwide. Those the Supreme Court has now cut away, saying that you have to limit a habeas corpus action to just the one federal district in which it's brought, which is the reason why there have been this blizzard of different alphabet soup cases for the Alien Enemies Act litigation. The other thing you'd ask about, well, how do lawyers do it? So one implication of that is instead of one lawyer or one great team of lawyers to bring a nationwide class, you now need different lawyers in every district in the country. And also that means you have to be able to litigate in that place. It means you need admission privileges to file suits in that place. I can't file a suit, for example, in the Western District of Pennsylvania because I'm not admitted there. I would need to go through a whole administrative process for that to happen. And so it has required far more legal resources than it would have required otherwise to vindicate the rights of all these people, even though you're right, of course, that it's a fundamental right, it's protected in the Constitution, yet nonetheless, it's very difficult to access it when you have that kind of procedural vehicle. The other thing is there's actually no right to an appointed lawyer in habeas corpus cases. Unlike in criminal cases, you could get arrested for, even fairly minor things. And you go through the criminal trial process, you're going to have a lawyer appointed for you if you don't have the money to pay for one yourself. But that is not true when the government imprisons you outside of criminal process. And so all these people who are getting detained have to pay for lawyers, or there have to be public interest lawyers who are able to take their cases. And that is a separate significant constraint. There's lots of detained immigrants all the time, every day, who don't have lawyers to file habeas petitions for them, even though their detention might be clearly illegal under existing law.
That's incredibly helpful. So on the one hand, it sounds like you're saying habeas is this incredibly important and right. It might be the only reason why Mr. Khalil is still in the country today, because a lawyer representing him managed to file a habeas petition at 2:10 in the morning when they learned that he had been detained. And at the same time, it sounds like you're saying that accessing this important right of habeas can be hard, especially for people who don't have lawyers, and maybe is becoming increasingly difficult because of Supreme Court decisions and actions that are restricting access to habeas. That sounds profoundly important. If there is any last thing that you would like the audience to know, to take away about habeas corpus, what is it?
Just that I think as a whole, our rights are up for grabs. They're being contested in this moment. And this one is as important as any of them. It's as important as the right to free speech. It's as important as the right to due process. You can't even vindicate those rights unless you have a court to take them into. So I just think it's really important for people to know and understand the role of habeas corpus in our kind of constitutional system more generally, and to remember that, just like courts have a way of pushing to take things away through popular resistance, we can also win them back. And I hope that's something that comes out of this very difficult era that we're living through right now.
Thank you. Those are words of inspiration that I think we can all hopefully move forward with. Thank you again for being here today, Ihlen, from across the coast at the early morning hour. And to everybody here who's listening, thanks for being here. And please tune in for our next explainer, which is, I believe, next week. Harlow, I think, is going to hop back on now and show some links that will give people
Yes.
access to these these explainers and other information.
Thank you so much, Adam, and thank you for your explainer. And thank you everyone for joining us today. Please tune in to our final explainer next Wednesday at 10:30 a.m. on Sanctuary Cities. You can also find this explainer and our future recordings on our website at migration.nyu.edu/migration-explainers, and link to this will also be in the chat. I'm going to keep the meeting open for access to links, and I hope to see everyone next week. Thank you so much.